And now another no-brainer money-saving tip from Progressive.
That doesn't sound good.
Paper shredder's jammed, but I think I fixed it.
Oh, well, try shredding these $50 bills then.
Seems like it's working.
Better try another $400.
Stop. Instead of using money, use regular paper. And here's a better tip from Progressive on how not to waste money. Don't pay too much for car insurance. Drivers who switch and save could save hundreds. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary.
Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller, find your next obsession, or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first three audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.
When a Kentucky woman disappears, the missing persons search group she often volunteered with must look for one of its own. Questions and possibilities abound as the search for a beloved mother, sister, and friend continues in this episode of Last Seen Alive. Also included in this episode, a request for information regarding the unsolved homicide of an unidentified young girl currently known as Opelika Jane Doe. Do you recognize this child? Thanks for listening to Last Seen Alive. I'm your host, Leah, crime analyst by day and true crime storyteller by night.
Your co-host, Scott.
First of all, we'd like to extend a quick and sincere word of thanks to you guys, our listeners. We've been making this show for 3 years now, our first episode released on December 10th, 2019, and over the past 3 years, we've been working really hard to consistently bring you new unsolved cases every 2 weeks and to continually improve the quality of this podcast. We really appreciate all of you who take the time to listen and consider these victims' unsolved cases, and, most importantly of all, to report any tips you may have to investigators. There would be no point in telling these stories if no one listened, so we truly value each and every one of you who do. On that note, if you think that bringing these unsolved cases to the public's attention is important and you think we're doing a good job of it, we ask that you please take a moment to leave a 5-star rating or review in your favorite podcast app. Other potential listeners value your opinion, so please help us bring these unsolved cases to more listeners by letting them know that you like this show. Thanks very much. Also, special thanks to Andy, the listener from Andrea's hometown who suggested her case to us. I'd never heard of her disappearance until Andy reached out, and it was a great suggestion. And make sure you keep listening after we wrap up Andrea's story, because we've got a second case to tell you about today. One where the public's help is needed to identify a little girl currently known only as Opelika Jane Doe. And now, on to Andrea's story. Andrea Knable was last seen alive on August 13, 2019. She was 37 years old at the time and lived in her hometown of Louisville, Kentucky, where many of her family members also reside. She was a single mother of two boys and was close with her family, especially her sister Erin. And Andrea had something in common with all of you listening to this podcast, which is that she had a lot of compassion for missing people. She cared so much about local missing persons cases that she was a member of a group called Missing in America, which at the time was an all-volunteer group of citizens dedicated to searching for missing people, especially in the Louisville area. Even though she was busy working and being a parent, Andrea would take her own time and go out and search for people who were missing. She likely never thought that she herself would one day go missing and that the volunteer group she belonged to would end up combing the area for any trace of her. Unfortunately, though, that's exactly what happened. In the time leading up to Andrea's disappearance, things had been pretty rough. More than a year beforehand, she'd been laid off from her job as an analyst at a health insurance company, a majorly stressful event for a single parent. Because of being laid off, she couldn't pay her rent and was eventually evicted from her apartment. On top of that, in January of 2019, she was a victim in a hit-and-run car accident. Fortunately, she wasn't injured because no one was inside the car at the time it was hit. But the vehicle was totaled, and since the driver responsible had fled the scene and was never caught, There was no insurance agency to cover the cost of the destroyed car, which left Andrea without a vehicle to use in her ongoing search for a new job. And because she'd been unemployed for so long, working odd jobs here and there, she of course couldn't afford to replace the vehicle. Because of these financial stressors, Andrea was living in a house that her mom owned, and she wasn't the only resident. One of her sisters, Sarah, was living there as well, along with her fiancé, Ethan, who worked in construction. That's Sarah's fiancé, not Andrea's, to be clear. And the couple were actually in the process of renovating the home that the three of them were living in. As for Andrea's sons, they were both staying with their fathers at the time of her disappearance, which makes sense. A house undergoing renovation isn't exactly an ideal environment for children. For that matter, it was less than an ideal environment for the three adults who lived there. Quarters were close, especially with the renovations going on, and as anyone with siblings can probably imagine, the two sisters clashed sometimes. It wasn't uncommon for Andrea, Sarah, and Ethan to disagree over things, and according to an overview of Andrea's case on Uncovered.com, Andrea said she sometimes felt ganged up on when she got in these arguments with her family members. Nonetheless, they were all known to still spend time together. For example, on the day of Andrea's disappearance, she, her nephew, and Ethan, that's her sister Sarah's fiancé, went to McDonald's to grab something to eat together. And after they ate, Ethan drove Andrea to Kentucky One Medical Center, which was a local hospital. And he took her there because she had some kind of facial infection going on that she wanted to get checked out and treated. They arrived at the hospital at about 9:50 p.m. and at 11:22 p.m., Andrea had been seen and was released. She called a Lyft to take her back home to the house that she shared with Sarah and Ethan. When she arrived at 11:34 p.m., though, there was a problem. She couldn't get in because the doors were locked and she didn't have a key.
She didn't have a key to the house she was living in?
No, and I'm not certain why she didn't have a key. I tried to figure it out, but there was kind of some different stories between sources. Some sources I've read suggest that the locks had been recently and deliberately changed and that Andrea was intentionally not given a key, but I wasn't able to pin down for sure when and if that actually happened. Perhaps it's also possible that Andrea simply forgot her key when they went out that day. After all, it wasn't as if she'd been alone when she'd left the house, and she wasn't driving, so she wouldn't have had her car keys with her. And for some people, their car keys and their house keys are all in the same ring, so maybe that was the case for her, I don't know. Either way, midnight wasn't far off, and Andrea couldn't get into the house, so she walked to her sister Erin's house, which was a little over a mile, or a little over 1.6 kilometers away. Erin is the family member to whom Andrea was closest. Erin says that Andrea was always there for her, even when she was enduring her own hardships. For example, Erin had gotten into a car wreck around the time that Andrea was evicted from her apartment. At the time, Andrea had only a couple days before she had to vacate, and she was busy getting all of her belongings and her son's belongings out of the house and, I assume, trying to figure out what she was going to do next. Even so, when Erin called and said she'd been in a wreck, Andrea put her own problems aside, literally dropped everything, and went to pick Erin up. When Andrea arrived at Erin's house on the night of her disappearance, Erin was outside on her porch enjoying a glass of wine with a visiting friend. It was immediately obvious to Erin that Andrea was upset. Andrea confided in her about a recent argument she'd had with their mother, one of their other sisters, Sarah, and Sarah's fiancé, Ethan. Andrea told Erin that, like I mentioned earlier, the argument had made her feel ganged up on by the others, and she felt as if she was being judged for her life choices. According to the timeline of Andrea's case on Uncovered.com, Sarah, that's the other sister she lived with, may even have hit Andrea during this recent argument.
I mean, it's not clearing out the cloud of suspicion around them.
That's just one element to the story. As you'll find out soon, there was a lot going on. So Erin let Andrea vent, but Andrea was so emotionally worked up that Erin worried the neighbors might be woken up by the loud, probably mostly one-sided conversation. So Erin ended up driving Andrea back to her house after letting her vent for a while. And of course, that was the house that she shared with Sarah and Ethan. However, again, Andrea was not let into the house. And that wasn't the last time Erin and Andrea saw each other that night. A little while later, at 1:38 a.m., Andrea walked back to Erin's house and asked whether she could stay the night there. And Erin turned her down. It was clear that Andrea was not ready to turn in for the night. She was worked up and she wanted to stay up and talk and talk and talk. And Erin had sympathy for her sister, but she also had work in the morning and she had to get up really early and it was already incredibly late. So instead of letting Andrea stay the night, she offered to drive her back to the house she shared with Sarah and Ethan again. And according to some sources, she also tried calling a family member to say, hey, make sure she gets let back into the house. But this was not the reply Andrea had hoped for, and it upset her enough that instead of accepting the ride, she set off on foot, walking all the way back to the house. Aaron later spoke about that night to WHAS 11 News, saying that, quote, Andrea came over and she told me she was upset about everything going on. And so we kind of hung out and she vented to me. I told her she should just go home and rest it off and everything would be okay in the morning, end quote. Thanks to her cell phone location data, we know that Andrea got back to the house at 1:54 a.m. And nobody let Andrea, who again didn't have a key, into the house. And she probably assumed that Sarah and Ethan were asleep. It was nearly 2 in the morning after all. So Andrea started calling her friends, seeing if any of them might be awake and willing to come pick her up. But her friends missed her calls, likely due to the late hour. According to Uncovered.com, Andrea didn't get any responses. We know from her cell phone location data that she remained just outside the house until 3:51 a.m., or at least somewhere in the vicinity of the house. We know from talking to people that she didn't actually get in, as far as we know. And her phone pinged for the very last time at 6:31 a.m. Weirdly, though, there was no location data associated with that final ping, which is strange for a variety of reasons, not least of which is the fact that Andrea always kept the detailed location data turned on her phone. This was actually a safety requirement for all members of Missing in America, that volunteer search group that she was active in. She was required to have location tracking on at all times so that if she became lost or injured or in trouble somehow while searching for a missing person, she could be quickly and easily found. Now, of course, when a phone pings, it pings off of a cell tower. So I have to assume that investigators know which tower Andrea's phone pinged off of, but for whatever reason don't have any more specific location data. And a phone can ping off a tower from miles away. So honestly, knowing which tower a phone pinged off of does little to help narrow someone's exact location down when we already know which city they were in.
So we know that cell phones use GPS or satellite connection to try to figure out where the phone location is if you have like offline maps downloaded or something.
Uh-huh.
So you don't necessarily have to have phone data really for navigation stuff to mm-hmm. work. So I find it very strange that they couldn't find any of that data from the ping and they're just using cell tower pings.
Well, it sounds as if someone, maybe her, maybe someone else, had turned off the location services on her phone.
I guess one of the other complications that could lead to that is you'd have to subpoena through Google, I guess, or Apple or whoever does your GPS to receive any of that data.
Yeah, but investigators do that all the time. That's super common and not a problem. But if somebody had that data turned off, you know, subpoena what? So the next morning, Andrea's mom, Cheryl, thought it was odd that she hadn't heard from Andrea ever since, you know, the argument the day before. So she texted other members of the family asking if anyone had seen or heard from her since the night before, but no one had. When the family realized that none of them knew where Andrea was, Aaron started texting Andrea's friends asking if they knew. But none of them had heard from Andrea since she'd attempted to reach out to them the night before either. At first, Andrea's family thought maybe she'd gone to stay with a friend for a day or two. She'd been pretty upset, and they figured that maybe she wanted some time and space to cool down. But by the time 4 whole days passed, during which no one heard from her, they knew something had to be wrong. So Aaron reported Andrea missing to the Louisville Metro Police Department. Andrea was friends with a woman named Nancy, who was the founder of Missing in America, that local search group that Andrea volunteered with. And Nancy was worried too, worried enough that she asked a private investigator they knew to help them find Andrea. And of course, other members of Missing in America, the group Andrea volunteered with, also helped with the search. Despite the fact that so many people were looking, though, Andrea was nowhere to be found. Naturally, investigators looked to the fathers of Andrea's 2 sons, since statistically speaking, when women are harmed, the perpetrator is most often a man in their life. However, it quickly became apparent to investigators that neither man had anything to do with Andrea's disappearance, which left 1,000 other possibilities. When it comes to Andrea's disappearance, there are far more questions than answers, and there are a lot of theories that have been tossed around, some perhaps more likely than others. One of the things that perhaps makes it so difficult to narrow down potential explanations is the fact that between her trips back and forth to her sister Erin's house, Andrea walked a total of about 4 miles that night. Late at night, by herself, while distracted by and wrapped up in intense emotions in an urban environment. Could someone with malicious intent have noticed Andrea walking alone and upset? Could they have followed her and perhaps harmed her at some point? It's certainly possible, although, for the record, the neighborhood Andrea lived in and had been walking in is much safer than average. It's called Audubon Park, and it's considered one of the nicer places to live in Louisville. So it's not like the streets Andrea was walking were rife with crime and malicious strangers. Still, crime can and does happen anywhere. Another complicating factor is the fact that Andrea was reaching out left and right to her friends, attempting to get someone to come pick her up. As best I can tell from what I've read, no one picked up when she called, possibly because it was so late at night. But what if she left someone a voicemail or sent someone a text explaining the situation and they decided to come pick her up after all? Could a friend or acquaintance have harmed her? If so, that would still leave a pretty wide pool of potential suspects. Andrea was social and very good at making friends. She was known for being able to connect with anyone, almost as if it was some kind of superpower. And because she also had an empathetic and nurturing personality, once she made friends, she tended to keep them. According to her dad, she'd been gifted in that way since childhood. So the list of people who considered her a friend is very long and filled with all kinds of different people from all walks of life. And then there's the fact that Andrea's family believed that she'd begun coping with her recent stressors by using drugs, namely methamphetamine, in the months leading up to her disappearance, which was really difficult for them to witness. Aaron told WLKY News that Andrea's struggle with substance abuse sometimes made it seem almost as if she had multiple personalities. Sometimes Andrea just did not seem like the same big sister Aaron had grown up with, which isn't surprising. Sudden shifts in mood or behavior are common in people who use amphetamines. And for the record, Andrea's struggle with drugs may have been the reason why Aaron declined to allow Andrea to stay over at her house on the night of her disappearance, or at least part of the reason. I think it's important to mention because it's clear that Aaron really cares for Andrea, and I don't want to give the impression that she was trying to be unkind or anything like that when she told Andrea no that night.
Any kind of drug use does change the dynamic of who you will and won't let stay at your house. Once you get into more aggressive substances like methamphetamine in particular, that really changes and really limits the amount of openness you would have for your house.
Yeah, it can cause all kinds of changes in behavior and problems. Really dangerous drug, as probably everyone listening to this knows. And it's totally understandable why, even if someone was a family member or a really good friend and they showed up at your house in the middle of the night, they're potentially under the influence of amphetamines, a lot of people would have to turn them down if they asked to stay the night. So that's understandable. Aaron told WLKY News that, quote, "We had a lot of advice during that time period saying we shouldn't enable her. And I feel terrible about that because I would rather enable her the rest of my life than to go through this," end quote. When it comes to Andrea's struggle with substance abuse, it seems as if she was probably first exposed to methamphetamine by a man she dated. It seems as if drug use was a relatively recent habit she'd developed. In a documentary on Andrea's case called Finding Andrea, her ex-boyfriend does an interview in which he says that he feels guilty for exposing her to the drug. This part of Andrea's life opens up a whole new array of possibilities. Illegal drug use is dangerous not just because of the toll the drugs themselves can take on one's body and mind, but because of the heavy criminal element associated with the drug trade. A lot of violent crime is associated with the drug trade, and being involved in it raises one's chances of becoming a victim exponentially. Even more concerningly, when it came to Andrea's struggles with substance use, it's alleged that her involvement with drugs may not have been limited to using. According to Andrea's ex, and also a platonic friend of hers named Matt, Andrea was also selling amphetamines. You know the guy Andrea dated, the one who felt guilty for exposing her to amphetamines?
Relatively, yes.
I don't mean do you know him. I mean, do you recall me mentioning him moments ago?
Yes.
I'm not trying to accuse you of anything. Well, he was incarcerated at the time of her disappearance, serving a sentence for methamphetamine distribution. He claims that when he went to jail, Andrea sort of just took over his dealing activities. We know Andrea was in a really difficult financial situation, having lost her job, her apartment, and her car. And she also wasn't happy with her living situation, and who would be, getting locked out of your own house all night? So She was probably eager to get a place of her own again. And desperate times yield desperate measures. To that end, her family members have remarked that she was a very independent person who hated asking for help. So it's possible that she may have felt desperate enough to make ends meet that taking over the selling operation temporarily seemed like the best option she had at the time. Currently, though, whether or not Andrea's alleged involvement in drug sales is directly related to her disappearance is unknown. Also, Andrea's friend Matt claims that Andrea owed money to another seller at the time of her disappearance. Whether or not that's true, I don't know. When it comes to the search for Andrea, lots of different people and organizations have been involved. In addition to law enforcement and Andrea's family, there were two private investigators who were brought on board by Andrea's friend, Nancy. One of those private investigators, Joe Fanciulli, is a retired homicide detective. He interviewed a variety of people about the night of Andrea's disappearance, including neighbors. One neighbor told him that late that night he'd heard construction noises coming from the house Andrea shared with Sarah and Ethan. What those noises were, I don't know. Sarah and Ethan were in the process of renovating the home at the time, although working on it in the middle of the night would perhaps have been odd, especially if they were being noisy enough to disturb the neighbors. We do know that Sarah and Ethan were awake, though, because they told Joe that when Andrea had been attempting to get into the house that night, they hadn't been sleeping at all during any of that time. They just didn't let her in because they didn't want to. And some people, of course, have wondered whether those construction noises might have actually been the sounds of some sort of fight or disorder.
To that end, do we know if a search warrant was ever conducted at the house?
Yes, the police did eventually search the house. Eventually.
I'm guessing it found nothing.
Not that I know of, not from the sources I've read.
Okay.
But I also don't think they searched right away. I'm under the impression that some time passed, and I don't know the exact date of their search, but it wasn't immediate. As we know, leading up to Andrea's disappearance, things had been pretty rough between the three housemates, according to that ex-boyfriend of Andrea's, who was interviewed in the Finding Andrea documentary. He claims that the night before Andrea went missing, she and Sarah had gotten into a fistfight. Whether or not that's true, I don't know, but either way, I think it's safe to say that tensions were running pretty high in the house. And on the subject of the house in the documentary, well, there's one theory it presents that has unusual origins.
Unusual origins.
As I mentioned previously, two private investigators, one of them a retired homicide detective, were brought in to assist with Andrea's case. But they weren't the only ones. There were also other volunteers, including a psychic. According to the Finding Andrea documentary, a week after Andrea's disappearance, the volunteer psychic went to the house Andrea had shared with Sarah and her fiancé, and the couple gave her a tour. When she got to the top of the stairs, she allegedly had some sort of psychic experience in which she claims to have felt a blow to the back of her head. And after that, when she got to Andrea's bedroom, she claims to have seen a hole in the drywall, a hole she felt was at the right height to have been made by someone's head impacting the wall. And to be clear, when I say she claims to have seen a hole, I mean seeing with her eyes and not some sort of psychic vision.
Okay, because I was questioning that.
Yes, I had to read my source material several times to make sure I had it straight. So the blow to the back of her head, psychic experience. Nobody ambushed her and attacked her at the top of the stairs. Hole in the drywall, allegedly something she saw with her eyes. But allegedly, when the police searched the house, they didn't see a drywall hole or any damage. And that was also allegedly after the psychic, as best I can make out from the timelines and stuff I've read. So they also painted Andrea's room soon after she disappeared, which has led some people to be like, oh, what if she was shoved into the wall and made a hole in the drywall and then they repaired it and then they just painted the whole room?
That was my thing. You've seen how many times I've cut open walls around here.
Yeah.
And done patchwork and how quickly that patchwork can be painted.
Yeah. You know, you don't have to paint the whole wall when you're repairing drywall, but also they were renovating the house, so...
Yeah. When we did the construction down here, holes in walls, they happen all the time, especially in work zones. And generally, you can just patch them up whenever you're doing drywall work or whenever you're doing tape work or whatever kind of renovations at different stages. You might just leave a hole for a while. For me to be more significant, it would be more dependent on where they were working in the house.
Even I have repaired drywall holes and painted in our house, and I can assure you that no foul play was involved. And they were renovating the house, so whether or not that's suspicious, who knows?
I will say it does take a little bit of skill for you to mask a hole well enough for new paint to not be necessarily noticeable.
I like to think I have that skill.
But again, he was a contractor by trade, you said?
Yeah, he was a professional. So I'm sure he knew what he was doing.
Exactly. I mean, we can DIY it and hide a 4-foot hole in the wall in the living room where we had to cut out for wiring. So
it looks great now.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Nobody would ever know, except maybe a psychic. Okay, so it seems pretty clear that the psychic is implying that Andrea may have been assaulted in that house on the night of her disappearance. But to the best of my knowledge, this theory is based only on alleged psychic experience and some alleged damage to drywall in a house being renovated. So I figured I should mention it since it's included in the documentary, but take it with a bucket of salt, because there was a lot going on in Andrea's life when she disappeared. Familial conflict was just one thing. I certainly don't think it would be fair to assume anyone's involvement or guilt based off of a psychic impression. With that being said, it's easy to see why the alleged tension and conflicts in the house may be a point of concern. When someone disappears, one of the first things we want to know is, did they have any conflicts with anyone who might have been angry with them? And in Andrea's case, we have some pretty clear answers to that question. Whether or not it explains her disappearance, however, is entirely unknown. There are a lot of possibilities. Perhaps the biggest takeaway from the whole psychic story, though, is that Andrea had a lot of people who cared for her, and they were willing to try unconventional means in an effort to locate her. Andrea was an empathetic person who'd been very generous with her time and energy, never hesitating to do whatever she could to help missing people and their families. Even when she got into using drugs, she was still participating in those search activities. Andrea was not having an easy time, certainly did not have an easy life at the time of her disappearance, but even so, she would think of people who had it worse, and she would go out there and try to do something for them. So certainly something to be said there. Now, this may seem to be at odds with her alleged decision to take over a drug distribution operation, which isn't doing anyone any good, but this is a complicated case, and there was a lot more to Andrea than that one aspect of her life.
Yeah, not all drug users are bad people.
No, yes. Certainly not. And most drug users are people who've endured terrible traumas.
They're victims a lot of the time also, and that's important to remember.
I will admit that in my experience, my professional experience, not in my personal experience, because I don't have any, the average person who sells meth is perhaps not as nice of a person as Andrea. But that's neither here nor there, because this is about Andrea, not them.
And remember, she was only alleged to be a meth dealer.
Yes, that's true. Notice I'm using the word alleged a lot. So Andrea's life was very multifaceted, and that's one of the things that makes her case so complicated. In the Finding Andrea documentary, retired homicide detective Joe Fanciulli said that, quote, "This is one of the most complicated cases that I've worked on in 52 years of doing this, only because it has so many tentacles. Andrea's life stretched into so many different areas, and she interacted with so many different people," end quote. Another theory on Andrea's case also involves drugs, but not in the way you might think. More on that next.
You love podcasts. The stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.
And now, back to Andrea's story. You know how Andrea was so involved in searching for missing people?
I really do, yes.
Well, this theory involves one missing person in particular. His name is Austin Games, and he disappeared from Louisville in 2017. Missing in America considered searching for Austin, as they had for so many other missing locals, but ultimately the group's founder, Nancy, decided against it. Her reason? She thought it would be too dangerous. Because Austin wasn't the only victim of the events that led to his disappearance. At the time, he'd been hanging out with a friend who was found fatally shot inside the vehicle the pair had been traveling in. Whether Austin met a similar fate is unclear because he wasn't in the vehicle when they found it, and he hasn't been seen since. It's believed that the homicide and Austin's disappearance may have been related to the drug trade. And so, Nancy, Andrea's friend and the founder of Missing in America, felt that searching for Austin would be too risky for her volunteers. The last thing she wanted was to put any of them in a position where they might meet a similar fate. However, Andrea may not have been as daunted by the case's connection to the drug trade. Some believe that Andrea may have attempted to investigate Austin's disappearance in an undercover capacity. Like I said, she was really social. She just had this uncanny knack to connect and make friends with anyone. So if anyone could probably pull this off, it might be her, but it would also be very dangerous. Now, whether or not Andrea really did so is unknown. It was something she had mentioned wanting to do, which is why people wonder about whether or not she did, but it isn't clear whether she actually followed through on the idea or not. If she did, the potential dangers this may have presented are obvious. The most recent professional, comprehensive search for Andrea, at the time of this recording anyway, occurred in June of 2022. A dozen search canines, their handlers, and other search professionals from all around the country descended on Louisville. They were working hand-in-hand with Community United Effort, a nonprofit search organization we've talked about before in other episodes. The search was intense, and the one dozen canines were all trained to detect the scent of human decay. At this point, Andrea had been missing for just about 3 years, and searchers knew there was a strong possibility that they were searching for her remains. However, no trace of her was found. And to this day, Andrea's dad, Mike, and her sister, Erin, have been working tirelessly to keep Andrea's case in the news and in Louisville citizens' minds. They're determined to find out what happened to her and, if she's alive, to welcome her back into their lives. Erin told WDRB News that if Andrea is alive and she could tell her one thing, it would be this, quote, "Andrea, I still have the same number. Please call me anytime. I live at the same place. Just walk through my door and I'll do whatever I can to make it easy for you to come back. Absolutely anything that you want or need, and if you're worried that we're upset with you, we're not at all." End quote. The past 3 years of not knowing and of missing Andrea have been heartbreaking for the Knable family and Andrea's many friends. So if you know anything about the disappearance of Andrea Knable, please call the Louisville Metro Police Department at 502-574-7111. If you want to remain anonymous for any reason, you can do that. Just call their anonymous tip line at 502-574-5673. And now, on to our next story, the story of Opelika Jane Doe. It's not known when or where Opelika Jane Doe was last seen alive. We only know when and where she was found. On January 28, 2012, a resident of the Opelika Mobile Home Park in Opelika, Alabama, made a shocking discovery. The unnamed woman was washing dishes inside her home when, through the window over the kitchen sink, she saw a dog playing with what appeared to be a head. At first, she thought the head had come from a doll, but as she continued to watch the dog, a horrible realization settled over her. The animal was playing with real human remains. The woman called 911 and police responded to the scene. There, in a brushy wooded area by the bank of a small creek, they found the partial, mostly skeletonized remains of a little girl. Later analysis would put her age at the time of her death as anywhere from 4 to 7 years old. Investigators believe that the girl's remains had likely been lying in that spot for anywhere from 8 months to a year before discovery. And they don't believe the little girl had wandered there herself. Rather, they suspect that she was a homicide victim and that her remains had been placed there. Since they didn't know the young girl's identity, they started calling her Opelika Jane Doe or Baby Jane Doe. And examination of her remains soon revealed that her murder was not the only act of abuse she'd been subjected to. It was blatantly obvious that in life she had been a badly neglected and abused child. Her bones showed clear signs of malnutrition and, even worse, physical abuse. She had multiple broken bones and there was damage to the orbital socket around her left eye. Based on healing activity that had occurred since the injury, it was likely inflicted months before her death or even as much as a year prior. They also believed that because of the injury, she was probably blind in her left eye. And this would have been visually obvious to anyone who encountered her. That is, her left eye would have looked noticeably different than her right, which could be key to identifying her. investigators have been trying to give baby Jane Doe her name back for 10 years at the time of this recording. Not a single person has come forward saying they knew her. It seems unlikely, bordering on the impossible, that no one in Opelika would recognize her, especially since, with a population of approximately 26,000 people, it's a pretty small town.
One of my first thoughts is that if she was so young and she was so poorly neglected, she probably never attended school.
Yeah.
So that would limit, like, a bunch of her interactions with the public.
I think that you're probably right. She was anywhere from 4 to 7, so she could have been preschool or kindergarten age, but she probably didn't get sent to preschool, and she may have not been old enough for kindergarten, or she may have gone to kindergarten somewhere else in the country.
Yeah.
But yeah, multiple broken bones, blind in one eye, malnourished. It really sounds as if this child probably was not in school.
Yeah, and unfortunately, probably most of that neglect and abuse came from the parents.
Yeah. Now, you know, I say that, but recently in the news, I've seen this really disturbing case where there's this sick police officer in New York who had been torturing and abusing his 2 elementary school aged autistic children, and one of them literally died from it. And they went to school, and their teachers repeatedly reported to Child Protective Services that they were afraid these children were literally going to die. And they did, and nothing was done. So who knows? Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe she did go to school.
Yeah, if she was being reported to CPS, though, there should be some
kind of record.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not sure, but I suspect that you're probably right and she wasn't in school. But investigators have turned to science in an effort to identify her. And although they're still not sure who she is, they've learned some things about her. For example, thanks to chemical isotope testing conducted on her bones, they know where she was likely born and raised. In a nutshell, the science behind isotope testing is this. Drinking water supplies in different parts of the world or country have their own unique isotopic signature, and those isotopic signatures can be found in the bodies of people who drink the water, their bones or hair, for example. Isotope testing conducted on baby Jane Doe's remains indicated that she was likely born and raised in the American South, possibly in the state of Alabama where she was found. However, investigators believe she may also have ties to one or more out-of-state areas. This information comes not from isotope testing, but from DNA evidence, familial DNA, I imagine, and tips they've received and reviewed during the course of the investigation. Areas outside of Alabama she may have had ties to include Orlando, Florida, Norfolk, Virginia, and Northampton County, North Carolina. So please, if you lived in or near any of those places 10 to 15 years ago, or if you have family who did, take a look at the renderings of baby Jane Doe that investigators have put together. They show what she's believed to have looked like while alive. Her eye injury gave her a distinctive appearance that you may remember if you encountered her. One thing that stood out to me when it comes to the places baby Jane Doe may have lived is this. The Norfolk, Virginia area has a huge military presence, especially when it comes to the Navy. In fact, Naval Station Norfolk is the largest naval station in the entire world.
Don't all 3 of those locations have pretty strong military ties?
Orlando also has a naval base, but the North Carolina location is very rural and doesn't have anything like that. There are constantly military families moving in and out of the Norfolk area, and I can't help but wonder whether baby Jane Doe may have been part of a military family. It's one reason that could explain her possible ties to Norfolk and to Orlando. And the naval base in Orlando is dwarfed by its counterpart on the coast of Virginia, but it does exist. If baby Jane Doe was part of a military family, this could also potentially explain her perhaps having moved states several times during her short life. And such a lifestyle, the frequent moves often necessitated by military service, could potentially have made it easier for her to go missing without people noticing, because military families pick up and move all the time. Of course, it's just a thought, and there are plenty of people who live in and around Norfolk and Orlando who aren't military affiliated. In any case, investigators caught somewhat of a break in baby Jane Doe's case in 2016 when a member of Opelika's Greater Peace Baptist Church came forward with valuable information. The church member didn't know who baby Jane Doe was, but she thought she recognized her just the same. What had happened was this. She'd been looking through some church photos when one in particular caught her eye. They were snapshots taken at a vacation Bible school the church had hosted back in 2011. And in one of those snapshots, a little girl was visible. A familiar-looking little girl whose left eye had obviously suffered some past injury. Now, at this point, reconstructions of what baby Jane Doe would have looked like when she was alive had been all over the local news. So pretty much everybody had seen this. So that's why she recognized the little girl. And the churchgoer, who was actually a vacation Bible school teacher, really believe that this might be her. So investigators evaluated the photos, and they agree that they're probably the only known photo of baby Jane Doe when she was alive. So whether she attended actual school, I don't know, but it looks like she probably attended Vacation Bible School, and you're right. That turned out to be a very valuable source of information. Now, although this is a meaningful development, unfortunately, the Vacation Bible School teacher didn't remember the little girl's name. And although the church had kept records of who'd attended for several years, they'd since been destroyed. So we probably have a photo of baby Jane Doe, but frustratingly, we still don't know her name. We also don't know who took her to that Vacation Bible School. It's possible that whoever did was her killer, or perhaps another family member who may have overlooked the terrible abuse the little girl was so obviously suffering from. Investigators are reasonably sure that baby Jane Doe, whoever she really is, has never been reported missing. And they say that any tip, no matter how small it may seem, may be the one they need to finally give baby Jane Doe her name back and hold her killer or killers accountable. Opelika Police Captain Jonathan Clifton told media in the Norfolk area the following, quote, "Maybe there's somebody there that knows something about her. Do you have an aunt or a loved one that's moved off and you never see this child or don't know what's happened to this child or somebody possibly got adopted? Any tip, anything that could lead us to a possible identification would be very helpful," end quote. Please take a look at the pictures of baby Jane Doe we've posted on our website. The link is in the show notes. The photos are also on our Instagram if you prefer to look there. And if you think you recognize her, please call the Opelika Police Department at 334-745-8665. The town of Opelika, including its investigators, is very invested in baby Jane Doe's case. Investigators diligently follow up on every tip they receive, so please, if you have one, no matter how small it may seem, let them know.
That's all for this episode of Lasting in Life. Thank you for listening. Make sure to check out our website, lastingalivepodcast.com, for photos from the story and links to the sources we use to write it. While you're at it, follow us on Instagram and Twitter at LSA Podcast. New episodes of The Lasting Alive go live every other Monday. See you then. If you don't want to wait until then to listen to more episodes, check out our Patreon where we have full-length bonus episodes available for subscribers only. Also, if you think bringing unsolved cases like Andrea's and Baby Jane Doe's to the public's attention is important, please take a moment to rate or review Lasting Alive and tell your friends to check us out too. We'd really appreciate it. Lasting Alive is written and researched by you, Leah. Audio engineering and editing is provided by me, Scott, in association with our production partner, Podcast Post Production. Check them out at podcastpostproduction.com for all of your podcasting needs.
And now another no-brainer money-saving tip from Progressive.
Marcus, what happened?
I was changing my oil and I spilled some on the floor.
Oh, well, use these $50 bills to wipe it up.
Perfect. Got any more?
Yeah, take a couple hundred.
Stop. Instead of using money, use an old rag. And here's a better tip from Progressive on how not to waste money. Don't pay too much for car insurance. Drivers who switch and save could save hundreds. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary.
92% of households that start the year with Peloton are still active a year later.
92% because of a bike?
Not just bikes. We also make treadmills and rowers.
Oh, let me guess, for elite athletes only, right?
Nope. It doesn't matter if you're an avid exerciser or new to working out. Peloton can help you achieve your fitness goals. 92% stick with it. So can you. Try Peloton bikes, tread, or row risk-free with a 30-day home trial. New members only. Not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial.